people in America fear their government, and the government is being run by too many powerful agencies like the IRS and others, I think it's time the people take the country back through their representative government.
You are listening to an American Free Press podcast. The complete reading of American Free Press weekly newspaper, number 12, March 21st, 2011. Libya Targeted, High Priests of War Will Profit, by James P. Tucker, Jr. Bilderberg luminaries, those world citizens who meet secretly each year in sealed-off resorts to control governments, resources, money, and people, are reportedly secretly plotting to push the United States into a broader war across the Middle East and Iran, apparently on Israel's behalf. British newspapers have reported extensively on the collaboration of the Bilderberg boys, including Nat Rothschild of the infamous banking family and other luminaries, with Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi's son, Saif. In the United States, only AFP is exposing this collusion of billionaires. Young Rothschild gave a party when Saif completed his PhD on global governments at the London School of Economics, LSE, a long-established incubator for those who enter the world of high finance and other power channels. Other Bilderberg boys who hung around with young Gaddafi included Sir Howard Davies, director of the LSE and one of former Prime Minister Tony Blair's British envoys to Libya regarding economics. Blair was also present. So was Lord Peter Mandelson, a Blair advisor, cabinet minister, and European commissioner, who now advises companies hoping to expand markets overseas. Saif became the conduit through which the British companies invested in Libya and through which the Libyan Investment Authority invested in British companies. Bilderberg-connected banks in the United States also get a piece of the action. Why are these Bilderbergers interested in sowing unrest in Libya? Mainly to provoke war that generates immense profits. A full-scale civil war in Libya, they evidently believe, will inflame the entire region, thus threatening Israel and prompting the U.S. military to enter the fray. This writer was personally told that Mandelson had been overheard saying, "If we can get the U.S. and European allies to attack Libya, the whole Middle East will erupt and an attack on Iran will surely result. Israel may want to join in as a bow to patriotism, but it will be mostly a U.S. action, and we can make it a big action." On the other side, the protesters are being run by the White House, Yemeni President Ali Abdullah Saleh, an American ally, claimed on March 1st. In a speech, he asked President Obama, "Are you President of the United States or President of the world?" That is a fair question to ask the leader of a nation already devoted to undeclared military actions 365 days a year across the globe, including various clandestine operations in Pakistan and elsewhere. Honoring Tucker, event to honor AFP's Jim Tucker, the Bilderberg Hound. Washington, D.C. is the place to be this April 9th. The staff of AFP and many supporters will be honoring AFP's editor emeritus, Jim Tucker, with a lifetime award for his 31 years of exposing the secretive, powerful Bilderberg Group and its allies. Page 2, personal from the editor. Second Amendment Schools. AFP readers may recall that I traveled to the remote hamlet of Harrell, Texas last August to interview David Thweet, the nation's only known school principal who allows the tiny district staff to be armed with concealed handguns if they are trained and licensed. I became curious about what Thweet thought of legislative proposals now circulating in Austin that would allow Texans with concealed handgun licenses, CHL, to carry their weapons on college and university campuses in Texas, so I called him. "We have a victim mentality," he said of America, a nation founded on self-responsibility and taking care of ourselves. He added that the college carry idea is not as threatening as those such as University of Texas Pan-American President Dr. Robert Nelson make it out to be. Thweet said the Virginia Tech shooting rampage and other deadly events in recent years could have been much less serious or perhaps avoided had there been some armed citizens nearby, since police will tell you they cannot be everywhere instantly and neither can campus police. In order to have a CHL, you have to be 21. So professors or older returning students and other staff and qualifying visitors would carry these guns, Thweet said, stressing that teens would not have them. Thweet added that it just isn't borne out in the evidence that those who exercise their Second Amendment rights, often seen as right of center politically, will usher in regular shootouts at the OK Corral. Naturally, I asked Thweet if the January 8th Tucson shooting sparked any second thoughts from him or elsewhere on his own school's CHL policy. He replied, "No." On another note, don't forget to come to Washington to help us pay tribute to Jim Tucker at AFP's April 9th Tribute to Tucker, first announced last week. It's shaping up to be a mix of honoring, lightly roasting, and otherwise appreciating Jim and his decades of work chasing, exposing, and angering Bilderbergs, their Trilat siblings, and other rogues. He also has written about the concealed carry proposals in Texas, it so happens. As noted, the event will be at the Capitol Skyline Hotel, which has good views as well as good rates. The event will include a luncheon, multiple speakers, and Jim's war stories from his years using his pen as a sword, all presented in a light-hearted, jovial, and friendly atmosphere. As Jim turns this page in his notebook, we want everyone to help us celebrate. Pencil this one in and please attend. For all the details, call us at 202-544-5977 and ask to speak with Pete. Mark Anderson. News you may have missed. Mainstream callers are paid actors. Ever wonder why the calls that actually get past the screeners on the radio shows hosted by Republicans in name only, Rush Limbaugh, Glenn Beck, and Sean Hannity, sound so polished and scripted, whereupon callers ask carefully crafted questions? That's because many of the callers were actually paid actors hired by the highly paid actor commentator's parent company, Premier Radio Networks. According to a mainstream press report, Premier Radio used talent agency Premier On Call to hire actors to call into the shows with fake stories and opinions. New Hampshire, a birther state? New Hampshire's state legislature is mulling legislation that would compel all presidential candidates to show their birth certificate in order to be eligible to run for office. The mainstream was quick to report that the bill had already been killed in committee, but supporters remained defiant that it could eventually be passed. They need to produce a certified copy of the long form of their birth certificate and an affidavit swearing to residency, Republican State Representative David Bates, one of the sponsors of the bill, told Associated Press. Global nonprofits. Has your favorite environmental foundation or charity been infiltrated by wealthy internationalists? In a recent opinion piece posted online, Michael Shaw, the president of the conservative group FreedomAdvocates.org, contends, foundations, non-governmental organizations, and nonprofits have been arranged from the beginning to promote globalism. The creation of the Federal Reserve, coupled with the adoption of the income tax in 1913, provided the one-world elite opportunity to avoid taxes through the formation of foundations and other tax exempts. This was key to creating the financing system that has promoted globalism and which now threatens us all with world tyranny. Ford exports American jobs. The good news is that Ford is making record profits. The bad news is how they are doing it. They are shipping tons of jobs overseas. Recently, Ford Motor Company announced record profits. So is all of this success for Ford translating into good jobs for the American workers? Unfortunately, no. Ford has been revamping its manufacturing operations to be cheaper, more efficient, and more flexible. Translation, Ford has been getting rid of American workers in droves. Gulag Guantanamo. Under the pretense of national security, President Obama signed an executive order, EO, on March 7th, which formalizes the U.S. policy of indefinite detention of anyone accused of terrorism without ever having to file charges against suspects or go to trial. The EO is largely directed at the few remaining prisoners of war being held at the U.S. prison camp on Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Previously, Obama had promised to close Guantanamo while campaigning for president in 08 and then again in 09. So much for that. Release Pollard? Former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger is the latest in a long line of power brokers, politicians, and plutocrats to lobby the president for the release of convicted spy for Israel Jonathan Pollard, reports Associated Press. Forbidden word, tariff. Donald Trump says the U.S. will never be able to compete with China unless we consider taxing Chinese imports to level the playing field. The fact is, we should be taxing Chinese products, a 25% tax. We owe them money. We'll pay them back very quickly out of this tax, Trump told CNBC. To pro-big business Republicans, tariff may be a dirty word, but its effectiveness in raising revenue and helping U.S. industry cannot be disputed. Book about Smedley Butler omits key facts. While the new book, Devil Dog, rightly commemorates the amazing life of two-time Medal of Honor winner, Marine Major General Smedley Butler, the book ignores the notable last years of Butler's life, in which he fought against war and militarism, best commemorated by his aptly titled monograph, War is a Racket. He opposed the U.S. going to war against Germany in World War II. Butler claimed, "There are only two things we should fight for. One is the defense of our homes, and the other is the Bill of Rights." He also said, "War is a racket. It is the only one in which the profits are reckoned in dollars and the losses in lives." War is a Racket, 40 pages, saddle-stitched booklet, $4.50. Order from TBR, P.O. Box 15877, Washington, D.C., 20003. Page 3, The Big Picture. Land grabbers, citizens set for head-on collision. Can determined activists stop what could become the largest land theft in U.S. history? By Mark Anderson. on Texas Independence Day during the Lone Star State's 175th anniversary. Texans United for Reform and Freedom, TURF, Texans for Accountable Government, Public Citizen, and several other groups, along with some affected property owners, gathered March 2nd in Austin to demand genuine property rights protection for Texas landowners. These critics of the Trans-Texas Corridor, TTC, the massive Texas portion of the contemplated NAFTA Superhighway or North American Union Turnpike, insists such protection is lacking in SB 18, the state's fast-tracked emergency eminent domain bill. Never before has eminent domain been this much in the spotlight regarding the TTC battle. The bill is supposedly designed to protect property owners from having their land condemned and seized in unconstitutional land takings. However, many believe SB 18 does not go far enough to protect landowners from Kelo-style abuses, i.e. the pivotal Kelo versus New London Supreme Court ruling, saying land could be seized by government for private interests, sidestepping due process. Eminent domain for private gain became the centerpiece of the public blowback to Governor Rick Perry's Trans-Texas Corridor and push for foreign-owned toll roads across Texas, TURF founder Terry Hall said in a news release to AFP. SB 18's critics want to prevent any eminent domain for private gain, with no exceptions. While relatively modest toll loops have been built that could be incorporated into the TTC, the long-sought scheme has been sidelined by determined activists. Whenever someone declares it dead, it resurfaces. Scandals have saddled the Texas Department of Transportation, TXDOT, so much that TXDOT Director Amadio Sanes was forced to resign. If the TTC is ever constructed full bore, perhaps the largest eminent domain land grab in human history would begin. Countless ranches that have been in the same families for five or more generations lie in the path of a mega toll road that would include rail and utility lines, wide medians for amenities, etc. Some design renderings show a right-of-way that is a quarter of a mile wide. This network would ripple through Texas mainly along two planned routes, TTC 69, which is marked with periodic signs, and TTC 35. TTC 69, along which this AFP writer has traveled to monitor its status, shadows US 77 and US 59 through Houston and onward to Canada through Port Huron, Michigan. The other route to the west heads north to Canada through Minnesota. Other free trade super tollways like the TTC that would help move mostly foreign-made goods through the U.S., such as the Port to Plains Corridor, are mapped out. If Texans fail to stop the TTC, a deluge of even more Asian merchandise would be shipped via truck and rail from Mexican seaports, north through Mexico and into Texas and beyond. The State House Committee on Land and Resource Management has started taking up eminent domain bills. We've witnessed repeated abuses of landowners' rights, both by weak statutes, overzealous condemning entities, and court rulings, TURF informed AFP, adding, "Something this fundamental to our freedom and founding principles is too important to rush. The House needs to slow down and get it right." Page 4, AFP on Freedom of Speech. Defense Attorney Fights for Internet Free Speech by Keith Hansen. After some legal posturing and sparring, it appears that a young independent journalist and a law firm masquerading as a news company are headed for a full-blown fight in federal court, where the issue is whether corporate profits can trump the free speech rights of Americans to debate some of the most important topics of the day. As reported in AFP's February 28, 2011 edition, Right Haven LLC is a copyright holding company that purchases copyrights for material, most of which come from the Denver Post and Las Vegas Review-Journal, then uses a phalanx of lawyers to sue website operators and bloggers who use the content with no knowledge it had become Right Haven's property. The most glaring example of Right Haven's tactics, described by copyright attorney David S. Kerr as scorched earth litigation, is the suit it filed against 20-year-old Brian D. Hill. Right Haven asked for $150,000 in punitive damages, but offered a settlement figure of $6,000. Hill, whose only means of support is Social Security disability, can afford neither option. Hill's alleged misdeed was using a photo on his USWGO.com website that he found through a search of the internet, not knowing the image first appeared in the Denver Post and was later purchased by Right Haven. Hill learned he had become a defendant in a federal lawsuit via an email sent by Las Vegas Sun reporter Steve Green, who attached a copy of the suit. Immediately, Hill removed the photo and engaged Wright Haven attorneys in conversations that reached no acceptable solutions for either party. Upset by the lawsuit and pressured into responding to a court summons, Hill wrote that he had unknowingly committed copyright infringement, but that he couldn't pay the settlement amount, an admission Wright Haven seized upon to move the court to find in its favor. Following Hill's response, Kerr, an attorney with Santangelo Law Offices in Fort Collins, Colorado, offered his services pro bono. Kerr is also a member of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, a nonprofit organization dedicated to the preservation of digital rights. When the firm's founder, Luke Santangelo, heard that Wright Haven's attorneys were threatening to take away Hill's disability, Kerr recalls, Santangelo said, "I'm on board. Copyright protection is important, but destroying people's lives with copyright is not what we're about." After notifying the court February 24th that Hill was being represented by Santangelo, Kerr initially requested that AFP not run a follow-up story about Hill's case, indicating he had been engaged in settlement negotiations with Wright Haven and wished to avoid damaging the talks because of any critical press Wright Haven might receive. But the negotiations broke down. Asked if Hill's tacit admission of guilt and his response to the court summons might negatively impact his case, Kerr told AFP, "I got involved with this case because of Brian's story. I think he's somebody that highlights my personal feelings about how copyright law has been turned into a tool to hurt people, not to protect expression and creativity. I think that copyright laws need to reflect the 21st century reality of digital media." Kerr believes going to trial may raise some serious issues that so far have not been fully addressed. "Unless these cases are highlighted," Kerr said, "we don't have that conversation about these types of laws. When someone like Brian is looking down the barrel of a $150,000 lawsuit for what he's accused of doing, then maybe we can start sparking these kinds of conversations and have the opportunity to get a wider audience involved to start changing the law to allow expression." Although a settlement might still be reached, Kerr stipulates that if the case goes to trial, it won't be tried as a First Amendment test, but its outcome will most certainly have free speech implications. "If people are allowed to sue Brian for what he allegedly did," Kerr said, "then that has the effect of reducing free speech. So in a way, it's not a First Amendment violation, but using copyright law in this way prevents and chills free speech." Internet whistleblower charged with aiding the enemy by Christopher J. Petherick. On the campaign trail in 2008, Barack Obama made a pledge to his backers that he would not do as George W. Bush and Dick Cheney did. If elected, he said, his administration would be the most open and transparent transition in history by working to tear down the fortress of secrecy that has been erected in the nation's capital. But news this week that 23-year-old Army whistleblower Bradley Manning has been charged with aiding the enemy, a capital offense, and is being held naked in solitary confinement on the U.S. Marine base in Quantico, Virginia, underscores Obama's lie. What did Manning do to deserve such heinous treatment, which we call torture when other countries do it, by the way? He is the Army soldier allegedly responsible for disclosing to the world via the WikiLeaks website a 250,000 secret cables and documents sent from U.S. outposts around the world to Washington. In truth, Manning's real crime is that he shamed Washington's establishment by exposing its secret duplicity. He revealed the dirty little secret that Washington's elites think so little of everyday Americans that they only share vital information with themselves, keeping the rest of us, the people who pay their salaries and bleed in their wars, in the dark. Thomas Jefferson once said, "The Republican is the only form of government which is not eternally at open or secret war with the rights of mankind." But that no longer appears to be the case when one figures there are 1,200 government agencies and 1,900 private companies working on secret intelligence and other national security programs in 10,000 locations scattered about the United States. And how guarded can the secrets be anyway when 854,000 people have access to them with top secret security clearances? But while Manning and WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange deserve accolades for their acts of courage, few Americans have come forward to support them. In fact, a recent poll conducted by a leading mainstream news outlet found that 68% of respondents say WikiLeaks' exposure of the U.S. government harms the public interest. If that's not bad enough, 59% of those surveyed contend the U.S. government should arrest Assange and other WikiLeakers and charge them with crimes for releasing secret cables. Will Americans come to their senses about those brave souls who risk their lives to educate us about the true nature of the American empire? Our founding father Thomas Jefferson once wrote in a famous letter to the great American patriot Edward Carrington that in Europe, governments there have divided their nations into two classes, wolves and sheep. In America, however, noted Jefferson, the remedy has been to enlighten the people by giving them full information of their affairs through the channel of the public papers, and to contrive that those papers should penetrate the whole mass of the people. That is why we believe Manning and Assange should be awarded medals for having the courage to deliver the truth to the American people, whether they want to hear it or not. Page 6, AFP on the financial crisis. Wisconsin's troubles began in Washington, D.C. by Keith Johnson. Icy winds off neighboring Lake Mendota make a fitting climate for the cold and bitter clash between Wisconsin's public employees and Republican state legislators. For weeks, tens of thousands of disgruntled workers and their supporters have converged on the state capitol to voice their outrage over austerity measures recently proposed by Governor Scott Walker. It all began February 11th when freshman Walker introduced legislation that would effectively strip the vast majority of public employees of their union's collective bargaining rights and force them to contribute a larger percentage of their salaries toward their retirement plans and health care premiums. The move came shortly after it was announced that Wisconsin would be facing a budgetary shortfall of $137 million by July and an overall budget gap that is projected to eclipse $3.6 billion by 2013. The day the bill was to be enacted, Democratic state senators fled to neighboring Illinois to deny Wisconsin's Republicans the one crucial vote necessary to put the legislation into law. Though Republicans hold a 19-14 majority over the Democrats, they are unable to pass any fiscal spending bills without a quorum of 20 votes. In a surprise legislative move on the night of March 9th, 18 Republican members of Wisconsin's state senate pushed through a bill that sharply reduces public employees' collective bargaining rights. The measure was introduced as a way to circumvent the required quorum by removing language on funding to allow the 18-1 vote. Other direct actions have been taken against the protesters themselves, who were recently ordered by a county judge to vacate the state capitol after business hours. Some demonstrators had been occupying the chambers from February 15th, but have since complied with the judge's orders and left the building without incident. Public safety concerns were also a factor after 41 rounds of hollow point ammunition were found on Capitol grounds. Public sector employees and their supporters have also gone on the offensive. On the morning of March 2nd, recall efforts were mounted against key Republican senators who colluded with Walker on the legislation. Under Wisconsin law, supporters of the recall effort have 60 days to collect approximately 20,000 signatures per targeted senator to effect an election do-over. Meanwhile, other states grapple with budgetary crunches of their own and have reacted similarly. Ohio state senators recently voted in favor of a bill that weakens workers' unions from collective bargaining on anything beyond the issue of wages, hours, and other limited terms and conditions. However, unlike Wisconsin, which exempts police and firefighters, Ohio's measure has the potential of affecting nearly all of its 350,000 government employees. While finger-pointing and name-calling continues, a major culprit responsible for Wisconsin's economic crisis is almost completely ignored. We should not overlook Washington, D.C., where the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, was born, where unfunded mandates are conceived and where backroom deals are made between corrupt politicians of both parties and influential K Street lobbyists. Wisconsin's problems apply to all 50 states where tax breaks for the ultra-rich are handed out as political favors following major elections. Last year, Walker gave $140 million in tax breaks to corporations. This alone exceeds the current $137 million deficit his state now faces. In addition, the U.S. government has been giving tax incentives to corporations that ship high-paying American jobs overseas. This has moved many private sector employees into government service while leaving others out of work or forced into menial positions that pay even lower wages. Moreover, the tax base that supports public workers is depleted. CAFR reveals Wisconsin has $123 billion slush fund by Mark Anderson. Are Wisconsin's government pockets empty? Not according to the state's Comprehensive Annual Financial Reports, or CAFRs, that represent off-budget public money pooled into various investments, a practice not shared with contributing taxpayers who are told the well is running dry. According to Wisconsin State CAFR, the state is holding on to some $123 billion in assets, a huge sum that calls into question claims about the current financial state of the Badger State. Yes, regular government budgets representing typical revenues and expenditures show that nearly all states are draining their wells dry. After all, free trade and outsourcing has largely destroyed large revenue sources such as factories. But if you examine these separate CAFR sources, the situation is far different. As quoted on the Daily Poll, a website promoting Representative Ron Paul, Republican Texas, which compiled figures from the Wisconsin CAFR, the population of the state of Wisconsin as of 2010 was 5,686,986 people. The state's figure of over $123 billion in total CAFR funds represents investments and capital net assets, which total $21,712 per person in the state of Wisconsin. Remember, many of those people are kids with no income. The Daily Poll added, "This summary compilation of the wealth of Wisconsin is for one purpose, to show exactly what the Wisconsin state government is holding in cash and liquid investments. Here is a jolting sampling of the larger totals from the Wisconsin CAFR for the fiscal year ending June 30, 2010. Total primary government various funds, $4.403 billion. Total University of Wisconsin System Funds, $365.8 million. Total House and Economic Development Authority Fund, $1.023 billion. Total University of Wisconsin and Clinics Authority Fund, $127.4 million. Total University of Wisconsin Foundation Fund, $2.006 billion, just to name some. All of this and more can be downloaded at Wisconsin's website, as can CAFRs from any other state at the respective state websites. State officials will claim that these monies are restricted to the funds that contain them, but there is no law that says this is the case, and they are transferred between each fund, intra-fund, all of the time, the Daily Poll rightly contends. Also, keep in mind the figures above are only for the state of Wisconsin. Government at all levels have to keep CAFRs listing their investments. In the case of the Badger State, there are in the neighborhood of 72 counties in Wisconsin, 190 cities, 1,260 towns, and 370 school districts, all of which could be holding onto billions of dollars worth of assets, stock, and mutual funds that only a few bureaucrats are aware of. Page 8, AFP's Spotlight on Congress. GOP expects Dems to back bill killing backdoor cap and trade. Republicans expect conservative Democrats to back legislation introduced into the House and Senate that will permanently bar the Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, from regulating so-called greenhouse gases. It's part of a plan to prevent the White House from bypassing Congress in order to impose costly reforms on U.S. corporations that some contend will drive even more factories from U.S. shores in search of lesser developed nations that care nothing about pollution. The House version of the bill, H.R. 910, was co-authored by House Energy and Commerce Committee Chairman Fred Upton, Republican Michigan, and Energy and Power Subcommittee Chairman Ed Whitfield, Republican Kentucky. It was introduced March 3rd and has already picked up 9 co-sponsors. Companion legislation, S-482, was introduced in the Senate on March 3rd by Senator James Inhofe, Republican Oklahoma. It has been sent to the Environment and Public Works Committee and has 43 co-sponsors. In a statement, Upton called the EPA's move to start regulating carbon emissions backdoor cap and trade. Cap and trade refers to a complex system for controlling carbon emissions by U.S. factories that is being promoted by some in Congress and Wall Street. Fiscal conservatives contend that cap and trade will likely lead to higher prices for gas and oil for everyday Americans as corporations shift the increased costs of regulations to Main Street. Whether at the pump or on their monthly utility bills, American families, farmers, and employers feel the pinch when energy prices go up, said Upton in a statement. The very last thing the federal government should do is make matters worse by intentionally driving up the cost of energy. Yet, that is exactly what's in store if the EPA moves forward with its plans to regulate and penalize carbon emissions under the Clean Air Act. Kevin Knobloch, president of the Union of Concerned Scientists, disagrees. He believes Republicans are pushing the legislation at the behest of multinational corporations, which care only about putting profits above the country's air and water. Specifically, the bill would prevent the EPA from enforcing the Clean Air Act, which mandates carbon emissions from factories as well as truck and car emissions, says Knobloch. The Clean Air Act says that when scientists identify a pollutant that threatens public health and welfare, government must act, said Knobloch. But now Representative Upton, working at the behest of oil companies and other big polluters, wants the government to shirk that responsibility. Former Senator lands posh lobbying job. Former Senator Chris Dodd, Democrat, Connecticut, used to be known as Wall Street's top errand guy on Capitol Hill. Now, 5 months after retiring, the five-term senator has taken one of the choice lobbying spots on K Street in Washington, D.C., where he stands to make millions of dollars representing media moguls on Capitol Hill. In early March, Dodd was named chairman and CEO of the Motion Picture Association of America, a job that usually pulls in a salary of over $1.5 million plus expenses, though the MPAA has not yet disclosed the specific offer it made to reel in Dodd. According to public records, when Dodd gave up his seat in 2010, his total declared assets were estimated to be valued at around $2.2 million. Even though Dodd chaired the powerful Senate Banking Committee and was long considered one of Wall Street's favorites, he was only ranked around 60th in terms of net worth in the Senate. Today, the average senator is worth about $13 million, according to congressional financial disclosures. While Dodd will be barred from directly lobbying Congress for another 2 years, that shouldn't stop him from doing big-picture action scenes with other branches of government, including the Federal Communications Commission. In 2009, the MPAA donated more than $150,000 to congressional candidates and political groups, revealing the close ties between the movie industry and government. Small businessmen win. On March 3rd, the House passed by a vote of 314-112 legislation that permanently rescinds an unpopular new tax on small businesses, which would be used to fund the White House's health care reform law. AFP has covered this issue several times in previous editions. Gold and silver coin dealers were some of the first businesses to object to the new requirement enacted under Obama's health care reform that would force them to submit 1099 forms to the Internal Revenue Service on all purchases of goods and services totaling more than $600. They argued that the new mandate would paper them to death, forcing them to hire new staff and raise prices just to deal with the new workload. Tea Party national leader blasts top Republican. The leader of one grassroots Tea Party organization is not sitting back idly as top Republicans play politics when it comes to vital budget cuts. Judson Phillips, the founder of Tea Party Nation, recently took to the internet to blast House Majority Leader John Boehner, Republican Ohio, for contradictory and sometimes confusing statements concerning how much Republicans want removed from federal appropriations. Charlie Sheen is now making more sense than John Boehner, Phillips wrote on the Tea Party Nation's website in early March. Sheen is the well-known Hollywood star whose recent drug and alcohol-fueled antics have cost him a multi-million dollar acting job on network television as well as his children. Because Boehner did not get the message, said Phillips, fiscal conservatives who support the Tea Party movement are going to back a candidate to run against Boehner in 2012 and should set as a goal to defeat in a primary the sitting Speaker of the House of Representatives. While on the campaign trail, Boehner had promised that he would push through $100 billion in budget cuts if Republicans take the House. He secured the backing of many conservatives for this tough talk and was able to trounce his opponent, Democrat and West Point graduate Justin Kasule, last November. Once the election was over, however, Boehner has taken to the airwaves, sometimes in tears, to roll back that promise, saying he may only be able to cut $50 billion. Thankfully, it appears Tea Party supporters are holding Boehner and other politicians to their promise of fiscal restraint in this critical juncture in U.S. history. Page 9, Judicial Corruption. Charges of Corruption Haunt Clarence Thomas, by Dave Gahary. Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas may have committed a felony when he issued false statements to a federal agency. The case of the corrupt high court judge stems from charges that Thomas and his wife failed to disclose that they had received significant financial support over the years from an organization that won a Supreme Court ruling allowing corporations to influence U.S. elections with their money. In this regard, both Thomas and Martha Stewart have something in common. But that's where the similarities end between America's domestic diva and a conservative member of the High Court. While Ms. Stewart was found guilty and incarcerated for 5 months, followed by 2 years of supervised release, including home confinement with an electronic sensor locked to her ankle, the odds that Thomas would even face an indictment are remote. The fundamental problem, according to what University of Colorado law professor Paul Campos recently wrote, is that Thomas knows that he, like the rest of the power elite that rules America, is largely above the law. Campos believes, in the United States in 2011, we have a two-tiered system of laws, and our political and financial elites operate with something approaching complete impunity, safe in the knowledge that demands they be subjected to the same laws as everybody else will be ignored. Thomas's conservative credentials and his devotion to the Constitution have won him many fans, but this blatant disregard for financial disclosure and the resulting uproar have led some observers to believe that he could be disbarred and prosecuted for violating federal laws. The 1978 Ethics in Government Act requires all federal judges to fill out annual financial disclosure forms. A complaint filed in late February on behalf of Protect Our Elections accuses Thomas of breaching his legal duty and violating the rules of professional conduct by knowingly and willfully failing for 20 years to state truthfully his wife's income. To make matters worse, 74 Democratic congresspersons are demanding Thomas recuse himself from any cases related to Obamacare. At the heart of this matter is a Supreme Court case called Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission, in which justices ruled in January 2010 that the First Amendment allows for unlimited corporate funding of political broadcasts and elections, overturning 100 years of established campaign finance law, according to the complaint. Specifically, this ruling struck down a provision of the McCain-Feingold Act that prohibited corporations and unions from broadcasting electioneering communications. The result of this ruling was a dramatic rise in anonymously funded political advertising in the 2010 midterm elections. Thomas cast the deciding vote. His vote in that case is not the issue, but his wife Virginia's conservative political activism evidently is. Ginny, as she is known, according to IRS filings, was paid $686,589 from 2003 to 2007 by the Heritage Foundation, a Washington, D.C.-based think tank whose goals include allowing corporate donations to campaigns. Critics claim that Thomas should have recused himself from the Citizens case, which led to him amending 13 years' worth of financial disclosure forms. Federal judges are required to recuse themselves from hearing any case in which they or their spouses have any financial interest. Critics also note that in 1991, when he was nominated to the Supreme Court, Citizens United spent $100,000 to support his nomination. Thomas provided the following excuse for not disclosing this information. It was inadvertently omitted due to a misunderstanding of the filing instructions. Critics claim that for someone in his position, it is difficult to see how he could have misunderstood a federal disclosure form's simple directions. How this case unfolds is anyone's guess, but only one justice has ever been removed involuntarily from the court, in 1795, and that justice was impeached. He was Samuel Chase, a signatory to the Declaration of Independence. It seems as if history is in Thomas's favor. But in the court of public opinion, the Supreme Court's only black justice is being taken to task over his transgressions. On January 30th, the liberal group Common Cause held a protest outside a Rancho Las Palmas resort, where those in attendance were captured on film making racially explosive remarks about Thomas. Videographer Christopher Hartsock recorded one individual saying that after Thomas is impeached, they should string him up and his wife too. Another man said that they should put Thomas back in the fields. Of course, if conservative Tea Party members had uttered similarly shocking remarks about Obama or Reverend Jesse Jackson, the national media would have obsessed about it for months. Yet, in a typical hypocritical fashion, no major networks covered this story. Similarly, representatives from the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People said they had no comment on the slurs. Page 10, Alternative Views on 9/11. New York Representative Ignores Real Terrorists by Michael Collins Piper. Americans who hold dissident views regarding the U.S. government's official version of what happened on 9/11 can expect to find their views demonized in upcoming hearings being held on Capitol Hill. Although the hearings convened by fiery conservative Representative Peter King, Republican New York, who chairs the House Homeland Security Committee, are ostensibly devoted to the alleged threat of Islamic radicalism in America, the fact is, by King's own admission, his concern about this matter was initially stimulated by his having heard remarks by some of his Muslim friends. In the days following the 9/11 tragedy, their remarks raised questions about the U.S. government's version of the 9/11 events. King, a fervent supporter of the Jewish lobby, is not Jewish himself. Rather, he's an outspoken Irish Catholic with a long history of energetic support for the famed Irish Republican Army, IRA, which some people, especially Anglophiles, see as a terrorist organization. Yet this congressman, who supported Irish Catholic efforts to break Britain's imperial occupation of his ethnic homeland, doesn't seem to understand why many people consider him a hypocrite in light of his frequent angry denunciations of Muslims in America and elsewhere who object to Israel's imperial occupation of Palestine and the oppression of the Holy Land's indigenous Christians and Muslims. King told the Washington Post January 24th that his long-standing friendly relationship with his own Muslim constituents in his Long Island district. The Post said King had been one of their community's closest friends, came to an end when he heard several Muslim leaders quoted in the local press regarding their 9/11 opinions. One of them, Ghazi Khan, expressed his doubt that Muslims were the ultimate sponsors of the 9/11 attacks. Khan asked, "Who really benefits from such a horrible tragedy that is blamed on Muslims and Arabs? Definitely Muslims and Arabs do not benefit. It must be the enemy of Muslims and Arabs. An independent investigation must take place." The Westbury Mosque's co-president, Saadfar Chadha, was quoted as saying, "The Israeli government would benefit from this tragedy by now branding Palestinians as terrorists and crushing them by force." Other Muslims angered King by pointing out that, in the immediate wake of the 1995 Oklahoma City bombing, there had been widespread allegations that the Muslims were responsible. This claim continues to reverberate, with many pro-Israel voices in America, including former CIA Director James Woolsey, insisting that Osama bin Laden and/or Saddam Hussein, who were bitter enemies, had either individually or in collaboration set in motion the Oklahoma tragedy. In any event, King told the Post regarding 9/11, "At this moment for our country, the worst attack on us in history, these people who I thought were my friends were talking about Zionists and conspiracies. They were trying to look the other way while friends of mine were being murdered." Note that King only considers conspiracies an inappropriate discussion topic when it comes to the possibility of Israeli involvement in 9/11, which many informed people consider to be conclusive, as outlined in AFP writer Victor Thorne's book, 9/11 Evil. Now, King is accusing his former friends at the Islamic Center of Long Island, where he often spoke and was even a guest of honor in 1993 when it opened its new prayer hall, of being extremists and radicals who should be under surveillance, despite the fact that no member of the center has ever even been accused of terrorism. Regarding 9/11, King doesn't seem to be interested in the known Israeli spying operation on American soil, involving so-called Israeli art students, who were reported in a Drug Enforcement Administration report to be closely monitoring the alleged Muslim hijackers of 9/11 just weeks prior to that event. Nor is King interested in the known Mossad operation involving at least two Israeli groups who were picked up in the New York area immediately after 9/11, after having been seen videotaping and celebrating the destruction of the World Trade Center's Twin Towers. Despite his professed determination to fight terrorism, King doesn't seem to be concerned about the fact that Jewish American writer Thomas I. Friedman revealed in a little-noticed story published in the August 3, 1993 issue of the New York-based Village Voice that a Palestinian involved in the first bombing of the World Trade Center in 1993, Ahmad Ajaj, was possibly a double agent reporting back to Israel's intelligence service, Mossad. Although the Spotlight and later American Free Press reported repeatedly about Friedman's revelations, as repeated in this writer's book, The Judas Goats, few 9/11 researchers have picked up on this fact. If they have, many have hesitated to mention it for fear of being accused of being anti-Israel or anti-Semitic. Another point lost in the fray is that the famed Al-Qaeda terrorist manual that was so widely discussed after 9/11 first surfaced in Ajaj's custody, sparking suspicion that the manual was an Israeli intelligence concoction. King also seems to ignore the fact that the first terrorist act against America in the Middle East took place in 1954, when Israeli intelligence infiltrated its operatives into Egypt in a conspiracy to bomb the U.S. Information Agency office in Cairo, along with British government offices, in a scheme to blame the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood for the crime. The Israeli intent was to make it appear as though the secular regime of then-Egyptian strongman Gamal Abdel Nasser, who sought to suppress the Muslim Brotherhood, was unstable and incapable of maintaining order, and thus was undeserving of American support. Nasser, who stood in the way of Israel's dream of expanding its borders from the Nile to the Euphrates, which encompasses much of the Arab Middle East, was then the prime target of Israel's imperial agenda. However, Nasser's security forces foiled the Jewish terrorists and executed several of them and imprisoned others. The public revelation of Israeli orchestration of the operation resulted in a major political scandal in Israel that is today remembered as the Lavon Affair. For years, Israel denied its involvement, but subsequently the Israeli government publicly honored the Jewish terrorists who had plotted to attack American interests in Egypt. And lastly, why isn't Peter King interested in Israel's attack on the USS Liberty? The Judas Goats, the infiltration and the subversion of the U.S. nationalist movement. Soft cover, 225 pages. $25 plus $3 shipping and handling. Is available from AFP, 645 Pennsylvania Avenue Southeast, number 100, Washington, D.C., 20003. Call AFP FAB toll-free at 888-699-NEWS to charge to your credit card. Ship Without a Country, Eyewitness Accounts of the Attack on the USS Liberty, soft cover, 96 pages. $15 plus $3 shipping and handling is available from AFP. 645 Pennsylvania Avenue Southeast, number 100, Washington, D.C., 20003. Time to Investigate Israeli Spying in U.S. by Michael Collins Piper. If Representative Peter King, Republican New York, is interested in fighting terrorism and treason, he should not only look at the first source of terrorism against America in the Middle East, the State of Israel, but he should inquire into the numerous high-level American government policymakers who have already been investigated by the FBI for suspected espionage and illicit influence peddling on Israel's behalf. For the record, they include such prominent figures as Richard Perle, former chief advisor to then-Senator Henry M. Jackson, Democrat, Washington, at the time Israel's foremost advocate in Congress, and later Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy in the Reagan administration, and chairman of the Defense Policy Board under George W. Bush. Stephen J. Bryan, former top aide to then-Senator Clifford Case, Republican, New Jersey, the ranking Republican on the Senate Foreign Affairs Committee and later Perle's hand-picked Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Economic Trade and Security Policy during the Reagan years. Bryan also founded the powerful Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs that spawned multiple other appointees to high office in GOP administrations. Paul Wolfowitz, Deputy Secretary of Defense in the G.W. Bush administration and later briefly World Bank President. Douglas Feith, former Middle East specialist on the National Security Council and then Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Negotiations Policy during the Reagan administration. And finally, Undersecretary of Defense for Policy in the G.W. Bush administration. And Jane Harman, former California Congresswoman, now head of the Woodrow Wilson Center, which is highly influential on U.S. foreign policy. Aside from the infamous former Navy Department-based spy for Israel, Jonathan Pollard, serving a life prison term, multiple American Jews in the military and U.S. intelligence in recent years have been investigated, disciplined, or otherwise convicted outright of various forms of disloyalty, including two of the more notable. David Tenenbaum, a Defense Department employee whose security clearance was revoked over suspicions regarding his perceived devotion to Israeli interests, and Ben Ami Kadish, a mechanical engineer for the U.S. Army who was convicted of relaying U.S. defense secrets to Israel from 1979 to 1985, including nuclear secrets. He was never punished for his treason, ostensibly due to his advanced age. See AFP's special report, Israeli Spies in America and the 9/11 Connection, 12 pages. 1 to 5 copies are $4 each, 6 to 39 copies are $1.85 each, 40 to 499 copies are 60 cents each, 500 or more are 50 cents each. We also recommend the DEA report on Israeli spying. This uncensored, unredacted version of the report, 60 pages, 8.5 by 11 format, is available for $15. Call 888-699-NEWS to charge or send payment to AFP, 645 Pennsylvania Avenue Southeast, number 100, Washington, D.C., 20003. Add 10% of order total for shipping and handling inside the U.S. Add 20% for shipping and handling outside the U.S. Page 11, Alternative Views on 9/11. Uncensored version of 9/11 report detailing spy ring now available by Michael Collins Piper. AFP presents, for the first time ever, an unredacted, uncensored reprint of the controversial report leaked from inside the Drug Enforcement Administration, DEA, exposing a wide-ranging Israeli spy ring operating on American soil prior to the 9/11 terrorist tragedy. Previous editions of the report released by AFP and circulated by others on the internet were redacted, that is, portions were blacked out, but those redactions aren't in this one. All the facts are there for you to see. Here's the story. Due to an unexpected computer miracle, when AFP ran out of copies and sent the report back to the printer, a techie at the printing company discovered that the scanning process removed all of the redactions. So AFP said, do it, and the redactions were excised, and now you can read the previously suppressed information. The wide array of evidence presented in this report confirms the fact, still unknown to the public at large, that Israeli intelligence operatives in the United States, posing as art students, were engaged in nationwide spying on government facilities and other institutions in the period preceding the 9/11 attacks. But what makes the report most explosive is that the report demonstrates that these Israelis were surveilling the alleged 9/11 hijackers prior to those attacks. And while there are some who doubt the alleged identities of the 19 individuals officially named as the hijackers, there is no question that the Israeli operatives were on top of persons whose names have been linked to 9/11 by the U.S. government version of the events. The story of the art students has become almost legendary among serious independent investigators of 9/11, despite the fact that the U.S. government and the mass media have done their utmost to keep it under wraps. At one point, spokesman for then-Attorney General John Ashcroft, a fanatic supporter of Israel, even claimed the story was an urban myth and that there were no such art students. In fact, although this is not mentioned in the report, some of those art students visited the headquarters of the newspaper The Spotlight, whose editors launched AFP upon The Spotlight's demise in 2001. Arriving without notice, they offered to sell artwork at discount prices that they said had been intended for delivery at the bank across the street, but the bank had rejected it. While in the Spotlight office, they were full of questions and obviously very alert to the activities therein, causing one conspiracy theorist on the Spotlight staff, this author in fact, to suspect these students were Israeli agents on a training mission. It was only later it was learned that these same art students and their colleagues were indeed Israeli agents, thanks to the patriot inside the DEA who released the report that AFP is now making available once again. Prominent Actor Gives 9/11 Truthers a Bad Reputation by Frank Whalen. Charlie Sheen, to his credit, is one of the few Hollywood stars to publicly speak out for 9/11 truth. However, the same Charlie Sheen who talks intelligently about a controlled demolition at Manhattan's former World Trade Center site also calls himself a warlock, as Sheen claimed during a recent mainstream news interview and in other forums. Sheen's odd remarks, sarcasm, and biting criticism of his critics in a recent interview with his friend of 6 years, radio host Alex Jones, could be interpreted different ways. But with those who view Sheen as something of a patriot, approve of him on Jones' show, calling Thomas Jefferson a part of the female anatomy? Some claim that Sheen's quirky behavior is an example of the crazy people who allege government involvement in the September 11, 2001 attacks in New York, Washington, and Pennsylvania. Yet others say Sheen is a media target precisely because of these contentious beliefs, perhaps to undermine his credibility. According to an affidavit filed in court, ex-wife Brooke Muller alleged that Sheen told her in a March 2nd phone call, "I'll cut your head off, put it in a box, and send it to your mom," as reported by Lynn Elber of the Associated Press. Considering other escapades in Sheen's life, we might conclude that if the 9/11 truth movement's beliefs and convictions are so fragile that they need to be propped up by someone like him, then one had better hope that Sheen's own personal controlled demolition makes a turnaround. Page 12, High-Level Crime and Corruption. Holder's Justice Not Colorblind Discriminates Against Whites by Victor Thorne. Barack Obama's presidency is quickly becoming the most racist administration in American history. Despite promising a colorblind country while campaigning in 2008, President Obama has overseen an overt campaign of prejudice that reflects his cabinet's true nature. The latest example of this racial hostility occurred when Attorney General Eric Holder appeared before the House Appropriations Committee. During this hearing, Representative John Culberson, Republican Texas, asked Holder why the Department of Justice, DOJ, dropped its suit against the Black Panthers for their well-known voter intimidation outside a Philadelphia polling station in 2008. At the time, Minister King Samir Shabazz, Malik Zulu Shabazz, and Jerry Jackson, all dressed ominously in flak jackets, black gloves, dark sunglasses, and combat boots, menaced non-black voters who attempted to cast their ballot. One or more carried clubs. In April 2009, these three Black Panthers were convicted of violating the Voting Rights Act through the use of coercion, intimidation, and other threatening actions. The only step remaining was to sentence them. But in May 2009, Holder's DOJ inexplicably dropped its lawsuit. On March 2nd, Culberson confronted Holder with the following accusations. There is clearly overwhelming evidence that your Department of Justice refuses to protect the rights of anybody other than African Americans to vote. After dredging up 1960s activists in the South, Holder's inherent bias shone through. In response to Culberson, Holder snapped, "To describe it in those terms, I think, does a great disservice to people who put their lives on the line for my people." In this context, the connotations are disturbing, for Holder has entirely missed what the Voting Rights Act was supposed to entail. Specifically, all voters deserve equal protection under the law, including whites terrorized by violent Black Panthers. Former Robert Kennedy aide Bartle Bull observed the Black Panthers that day and called their actions the most blatant form of voter intimidation he had ever seen. In addition, former DOJ attorney J. Christian Adams called the case against the Black Panthers a slam dunk, the easiest he had ever seen. Yet Adams testified under oath that Holder's cronies, Loretta King and Steve Rosenbaum, told their subordinates to dismiss all charges and not pursue any voter intimidation cases on behalf of white victims. Worse, when the U.S. Civil Rights Commission investigated this matter, the DOJ ordered its attorneys to ignore all subpoenas. Amid cries of blatant racism, Culberson promised to overturn this miscarriage of justice. During his questioning of Holder, Culberson broached the subject of hypocrisy. "There's a pattern of a double standard here. We're really going to pursue this. This is not acceptable." If justice is supposed to be blind, Holder should learn that, as Attorney General, he represents every American citizen, regardless of color, economic status, religion, or beliefs. Page 13, AFP News and Views. American Nationalists Fight for Cultural Survival, by James P. Tucker, Jr. Nationalist Americans are fighting to save their European culture as illegal, non-white immigrants pour in from south of the border. While the number of whites is decreasing, with young white families having fewer and fewer children, millions of criminal aliens are having large families. In some states, whites are now in the minority. Without any remedial action, according to the U.S. Census Bureau, CB, whites will become a minority in the U.S. According to the CB's latest figures, Texas has already joined California as a place where whites are the majority minority, as the white population dropped to 45% in 2010, and the trend continues. In the first four states for which the CB has released details, New Jersey, Louisiana, Mississippi, and Virginia, the number of whites under age 18 has declined, while the number of non-whites, including some educated Asians, has increased in the past decade. Nationwide, the numbers point to whites becoming a minority of Americans by 2051, the CB says. Yet, while the increase in the impoverished, uneducated, illegal alien population is great, the increase in the crimes they commit is greater. This is no surprise. When you enter this country illegally, it is a crime in the first place. So why expect criminals to stop committing crimes, especially in such tough economic times? Violent crimes are frequent. Drug gangs infiltrate largely white suburbia to conduct their deadly wars. To confirm this, visit the historic town of Culpeper, Virginia, 70 miles from Washington, D.C., and consider the Border Patrol officers killed by illegal aliens on U.S. soil, or the rancher killed on his own land as illegal aliens butchered his cattle, cut out as much beef as they could carry, and continued walking north. The list goes on. But how is Congress reacting? By demanding amnesty, of course, whereby those staying in the U.S. illegally would be forgiven, not arrested and deported as would be the case if an American illegally crossed into Mexico, where border laws are tough. Ours should be equally tough. Is that asking too much? Polls show most Americans are outraged by our open borders and have started to fight back. Volunteers are helping landlords on the border defend their homes. Others provide them with food, drink, and shelter. There is no sovereignty without secure borders. Commentary: Obama flip-flops on marriage, caters to far left, by Pete Papaheraklis. When Barack Obama ran for president on a motto of change, he neglected to clarify the kind of change he envisioned. His latest quest to change America involves destroying the institution of marriage and the traditional family, as we've known them since the beginning of time. In his order to Attorney General Eric Holder on February 23rd, he refused to defend the 1996 Defense of Marriage Act, DOMA, and referred to it as legally indefensible. DOMA defines marriage as only the union of one man and one woman, while clarifying that states are not required to recognize gay marriages performed in other states. The Supreme Court never had a problem upholding this traditional definition of marriage in the past, as indicated in precedent-setting cases from Baker v. Nelson to Murphy v. Ramsey in 1885, when Utah was denied statehood until it passed a law ensuring that only marriages between one man and one woman would be recognized. Although Obama often quotes or misquotes scripture in an attempt to be perceived as a Christian, he doesn't seem to be familiar with the story of Adam and Eve. They are considered the first people. They weren't named Adam and Fred. While some critics even feel that Obama's latest actions are an impeachable offense, on February 28th, House Speaker John Boehner, Republican Ohio, announced that his colleagues will intervene in DOMA legal cases. When taking office, Obama swore to preserve, protect, and defend the U.S. Constitution, which does not empower the president to dispense with laws he feels are somehow unconstitutional. To simply declare a law indefensible is a dereliction of duty. He is duty-bound to ensure that laws are faithfully executed or carried out. It is up to Congress or the Supreme Court to assess their constitutionality. Another backlash to Obama's pro-homosexual stance comes from his traditionally devout supporters. A coalition of 34,000 black churches is blasting his decision. Reverend Anthony Evans, who heads the National Black Church Initiative, says Obama has violated the Christian faith by failing to uphold Jesus' teaching that marriage is between a man and a woman. Evans says black churches must reassess their extraordinary support of him. For more than a century, those seeking global governance have been undermining Western civilization's foundations. All one has to do is look at what same-sex marriage has done to Massachusetts in order to see the type of change Obama has in store for us. There, the tables have turned to where those espousing traditional views on marriage are persecuted by being denied jobs, adoptions, or having their children brainwashed with gay ideas in public schools. Speaking out against homosexual marriage is considered hate speech. Maybe it's time to ask ourselves, who is this guy occupying the White House? He wants to turn our way of life upside down, yet we know relatively little about him. He won't produce a valid birth certificate to prove he's an American, yet he has access to the secret codes to launch nuclear missiles. We cannot be certain of his real name, we're not sure about his religion, we can't see his medical records, and we're not sure exactly where he went to school or the identity of his real father. Where does Obama get the nerve to say that the traditional definition of marriage is legally indefensible? Who asked him anyway? He was put in office to defend the Constitution and faithfully administer the laws of the U.S., not to rewrite them at a whim. There's no doubt Obama is working hard, but the question is, who is he working for? Page 15, The Dark Side with Victor Thorne. Noted lawyer, RFK shooter was hypno-programmed, by Victor Thorne. Not surprisingly, the California Parole Board, for the 14th time in 41 years, denied parole to Sirhan Sirhan, the quiet man convicted of assassinating Robert F. Kennedy in 1968, for which he is serving a life sentence. What startled many following this ruling was the information delivered by Sirhan's lawyer for this parole hearing. That noted attorney is William F. Pepper, known for his involvement in an unsuccessful 9/11 ballot initiative in New York, and for authoring a book on Martin Luther King Jr.'s killing called An Act of State. At Sirhan's parole hearing, Pepper blatantly contradicted the government's official version of events. On March 1st, Pepper told ABC News, Sirhan was hypno-programmed, he was set up, he was used, he was manipulated. As this writer chronicled in a recent AFP book release, New World Order Assassins, at least 13 shots were fired within the pantry of LA's Ambassador Hotel on the night Kennedy was murdered. Sirhan's handgun held a maximum of 8 bullets. Sirhan could not have had time to reload. Pepper addressed another inconsistency. 10 independent witnesses say Sirhan was always in front of Bobby, never behind him, said Pepper. But the autopsy says Bobby was shot at close range from behind. In a March 2nd interview with the UK's Daily Telegraph, Pepper continued to confront the logistical impossibility of Sirhan being the primary gunman. "We know Sirhan did not shoot the lethal bullets," Pepper stressed. "Witnesses said he was standing in the wrong place. He was there only as a distraction." Although Sirhan initially confessed to this political killing, Pepper attributes his false admission to Sirhan being a prototypical Manchurian candidate. Sirhan was put through a process involving hypnosis and chemicals, Pepper claims. However, in this writer's considered opinion, Pepper reached an incorrect conclusion, a trap that numerous conspiracy researchers have fallen into. Namely, Sirhan wasn't hypno-programmed to kill RFK, but instead was led to believe that he fired the shots that killed RFK when he didn't. This distinction is vital because Sirhan played the fall guy. RFK's actual killer slipped away undetected. In New World Order Assassins, the identity of the shooter is revealed. Pepper, representing Sirhan for the first time, pushed the envelope even further by demanding that Sirhan didn't act alone and that a second gunman actually fired the kill shot. On March 2nd, Pepper told Daily Telegraph journalist John Swain, "Someone, some group, or some agency did this." When Swain asked if he was referring to elements within the U.S. government, Pepper replied with an element of intrigue. Perhaps. But Terry Thornton of the California Department of Corrections refused to consider any new evidence. "The board accepts as fact the guilty verdict," Thornton said. In this light, Sirhan's parole was refused due to the insufficient remorse shown. Still, Sirhan told the two-member panel, "I don't remember pulling a gun from my body. I don't remember aiming it at any human being. Everything was hazy in my head. I'm not trying to evade anything." Pepper echoed this sentiment. "There is no doubt Sirhan does not remember the critical events. He is not feigning it. It's not an act. He does not remember it." Thorne's New World Order Assassins, soft cover, $30 plus $5 shipping and handling, is available only from AFP's First Amendment books. Send cash, check, or money order to AFP, 645 Pennsylvania Avenue Southeast, number 100, Washington, D.C., 20003. For faster ordering, call us toll-free at 888-699-6397 and charge to Visa, MasterCard, Amex, or Discover. Page 17, The Ryan Report from Vince Ryan. "Eyewitness to RFK killing says Bobby was set up," by Vince Ryan. In the July-August 2003 edition of the revisionist historical journal, The Barnes Review, the lead story focused on the true story of the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy in the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles on June 5, 1968. As this remarkable article notes, the author of the story was listed as anonymous, though the writer is well known to staffers at both The Barnes Review and AFP, and the writer's testimony was included in Michael Collins' Piper book on the JFK assassination, Final Judgment. The following is a key portion of that article. "In late May and early June of 1968, I was working with Senator Robert F. Kennedy's campaign in Oregon and California in his bid to become the Democratic nominee for president. I was on the staff of Bill Wilson, the New York and Hollywood producer who handled production for the campaign. Senator Kennedy had just returned from Oregon, where he campaigned to win over Oregon Democrats opposing Senator Eugene McCarthy, Democrat Minnesota. When I arrived at campaign headquarters in L.A., the mood was upbeat. Though McCarthy defeated RFK in Oregon, the real prize was California. They were on a roll and working well together. Everyone thought that if RFK could take California, he could win the presidency. Everything was looking good for Bobby. Many people associated with production went to the Ambassador Hotel for the victory speech. I caught up with the campaign's press secretary, Frank Mankiewicz, and some of his people. One of them asked if I would sit with Bobby in a hotel room while he was interviewed by a local radio station prior to giving his speech. There were a half dozen of us who agreed to be the audience. Along with other staffers, I was seated close to Kennedy and the interviewer. In no time, the interview was over. RFK gave a rousing victory speech, and when he started to finally leave the ballroom, I was surprised to see him turn around and start walking through the kitchen door, even though I was sure that he would go out through the ballroom. Clearly, someone or something influenced him to alter his normal procedure of going through the crowd. His decision to leave through the kitchen was alien to his nature. I was standing close to the kitchen door, but not close enough to see the actual shooting itself. There were hundreds of balloons floating around the ceiling. It sounded like the balloons were popping when I heard people saying there were gunshots. There were a lot of shots. A man standing close to me had blood on his face. I looked around for the guards, but they were standing by the doors, not making any move. I ran to the guard closest to me and told him that there were shots being fired. He thought I was trying to trick him into leaving his post so that I could let friends in from the lobby. As they wheeled RFK out, his head and arms were so limp that it looked like all life was out of him. Later, when I learned the doctors were still working with him at the hospital, I was surprised he lived for as long as he did. I walked back to the ballroom with others. We saw sports legends Rosie Grier and Rafer Johnson walk out with Sirhan Sirhan between them. It looked like he was on something, perhaps some sort of drug. He didn't look normal. It didn't look like he had his wits about him to shoot straight. In fact, in a lot of published evidence that has since come out, there is good reason to believe that Sirhan was under some sort of mind control, either through drugs or hypnosis. A producer and I looked at the bullet holes in the frame around the door. There were too many bullet holes for one man to have fired, to have come from a single gun. Later, I was very intrigued to learn from Piper that Mankiewicz had written an article for Washingtonian magazine describing his last days with Bobby Kennedy. In that article, Mankiewicz described how he had insisted that Bobby leave through the ballroom, but that Bobby had said instead that he wanted to leave through the kitchen. That was not the conversation I heard. In his book, Final Judgment, Piper points out that Mankiewicz started his career as a public relations man for the Anti-Defamation League, ADL, of B'nai B'rith in Los Angeles. An interesting point, since Piper his book contends that Israeli intelligence played a part in the assassination of both President Kennedy and Senator Kennedy. Clearly, it appears from his first-hand account and from Piper's research that what has been reported over the years on the assassination of RFK is not what really happened. The complete version of this article, along with many other great historical reports, is available for $8 from the Barnes Review. Call 877-773-9077 to order via major credit card or send check or money order to TBR, P.O. Box 15877, Washington, D.C. 20003. Editorial: A Warning for U.S. Warmongers, Keep Hands Off Libya, by Willis A. Cardo. If the mainstream media is to be believed, Muammar Gaddafi is an unstable personality. We are glad that he is the president of Libya, not the United States. That being said, we should keep our greedy hands off that country. We have no business there. No, we don't need Libyan oil. We have more than enough in the ground right here and in Alaska to run American industry, automobiles, diesel locomotives, and trucks for heating, etc., for the next century. Editor Emeritus Jim Tucker, on page 1 of this edition of AFP, reports that we are currently engaged in undeclared military actions 365 days a year across the globe, including various clandestine operations in Pakistan and elsewhere. So why not Libya, too? Well, the reason is simple. It is time to stop. It is time to halt internationalist, undeclared, pointless, expensive, no-win aggression, and time for sanity in foreign affairs to begin anew. It is time for Americans to mind America's own business that we know a little about, not the business of other countries, groups, and tribes that we only think we understand. If you think that this sounds like the policy recommended by George Washington and all the other founders and followed by all the presidents up to Woodrow Wilson, who maneuvered us into a European war which then became World War I, you are right. As Dwight Eisenhower sagely observed, America must reject the military-industrial complex. The tragedy of our foreign policy is driven not by what our leaders believe is best for the people, but by the drive for profits by the munitions makers, bankers, and other riffraff who profit from death, debt, destruction, and defeat. Stay out of Libya. Reject the importunings of traitors and foreign interests like Israel. Let's do what is right for America for a change. Page 18, News and Views from AFP. Federal fraud apparent in two cases, but will courts cover for the feds? By Pat Shannon. Two federal trials of national significance at opposite ends of the country moved to the forefront on March 7th, but because of the government's questionable position in both, neither is expected to garner much attention from the mainstream media. In Statesville, North Carolina, Liberty Dollar founder Bernard von Nothaus, maintaining Federal Reserve notes are a fraud upon the public, is defending the people's right to circulate silver coin as money. With a few million one-ounce coins circulating since 1998 and a few thousand people trading the Liberty Dollars in everyday commerce, a courtroom packed with the defendant's supporters is expected after the jury is seated. Texas Representative Ron Paul, Republican, has been subpoenaed by the defense. The prosecution intends to finish its case in a week, but von Nothaus has asked for 6 weeks to complete his defense. Meanwhile, in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, jailed attorney Edgar Steele, 65, stands accused of attempted murder for hire of his wife and mother-in-law. Federal prosecutors allege that Steele hired handyman Larry Fairfax to plant car bombs on his wife's SUV, but have not explained how such an act would have harmed her mother 500 miles away in Oregon. They also claim that the motive was to collect a life insurance payout, but the Steeles have not carried any life insurance since their youngest child left home on her own a few years ago. Fairfax has reportedly been a government informant for a decade or more, particularly in drug cases. Steele, seen as a friend of the Patriot Movement, has been denied bail and has been incarcerated since last June, but even his wife has charged from the beginning that the case was fabricated and has demanded his release. The FBI has produced at least two recordings claiming that the voices heard are those of Steele and Fairfax discussing the details of the purported murder-for-hire scheme. However, when the defense produced the affidavit of expert witness Dr. George Papkin, refuting the authenticity of the audio, the prosecution motioned for and was granted a 45-day continuance, as well as a change of venue to Boise. Papkin concluded that, with a reasonable degree of scientific probability, the recordings do not represent a true and valid representation of reality and are unreliable. In addition, one court watcher told AFP that the prosecutor was nervously and visibly shaking when presented with and arguing against this startling evidence. Only 1 week earlier, U.S. District Court Judge B. Lynn Windmill had denied a defense motion to continue the trial, but reversed herself to give the prosecution more time to handle this new roadblock. One of these cases could further expose the century-old banking fraud, while the other could result in jail sentences for federal agents rather than for their targeted but innocent victim. AFP will follow each case closely. Bad prosecutors, corrupt judges have become the norm, by Jim Trafficant. Now a convicted felon, Pennsylvania court judge Mark Chavarella would sentence juvenile offenders to the state's child care center on a certain condition. With the welfare of those youths in his heart and feeding his bank account, he received millions of dollars off the backs of youngsters who, it turns out, were not as incorrigible as the judge himself. Moreover, justices have actually been appointed to the federal bench by underworld figures. People charge that I'm just vindictive because of my many run-ins with judges, but that's false. In the 1970s, the chief judge of the Northern District Court of Ohio, Frank James Batista, now deceased, was actually filmed by FBI agents while meeting with known underworld figures in Cleveland. This development made headlines, but nothing was done about it. Nada. The feds needed something from Batista, the federal judge who stripped John Demjanjuk of his citizenship and sent him to Israel to stand trial as an alleged Nazi war criminal. I guarantee you that Batista got that case because he was beholden to the FBI. He was told to take care of the Demjanjuk matter. He did. Federal documents later stated that a certain FBI agent in Northeast Ohio was on the mob's payroll. I forced the court to allow my introduction of an FBI affidavit in 1983 concerning this information. I asked the FBI some questions in court, agent's name withheld. JT is me questioning the FBI agent who submitted the affidavit after questioning two informants about organized crime in Northeast Ohio. JT, did you submit this affidavit to the court? FBI agent, yes. JT, is that your signature? FBI agent, yes. JT, to your knowledge, was there ever an FBI investigation into this revelation? FBI agent, I don't know. JT, did you recommend or request an investigation into this matter? FBI agent, no, no. The affidavit said that a key FBI leader was on the mob's payroll, and when forced to retire due to age limitations, he was made a police chief of one of Ohio's bigger cities at the mob's direction, and there was no investigation. Government prosecutors pleaded with the judge to not allow that affidavit to be introduced at my first trial. They cried, "The information is classified, national security." The trial judge was not about to upset the powerful Justice Department until I said, "You want me in prison so bad you're making a big mistake, and it will come back to haunt you on appeal." She exclaimed, "I'm going to let it in." The prosecutor slumped in his chair. The FBI was in shock. It was then that I called as my witness the FBI agent who signed the affidavit. If looks could kill, you would not be reading this column. But bad prosecutors and judges have become the norm. Consider new Supreme Court Justice Elena Kagan. The issue is partial birth abortion. In her capacity as Bill Clinton's associate White House counsel, she issued a memo that misrepresented an expert panel's report. The report stated they could not identify any circumstances under which partial birth abortion would be the only option to save the life or preserve the health of the woman. Kagan's memo countered, This would be a disaster for our cause. She listed suggested options that the Clinton administration should pursue to replace the original report's statement, prompting the Supreme Court to overturn Nebraska's partial birth abortion ban. Kagan defrauded the court and should be prosecuted, yet she was made the Supreme Court's 112th justice. Thomas Jefferson wrote, "Beware the appointment of federal judges for lifetime terms, because they can take the Constitution and mold it like clay in their hands. Get back at me."